It's Friday, December 1st, and you're listening to Michigan News from MLive. I'm Patrick Shea. This week on the show, a Detroit police officer who fired rubber bullets at photojournalists in 2020 could face charges after all. Then we'll hear about two political candidates who say a pro-Israel lobbying group offered them millions of dollars to run against U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib. And the regular season of college football has come to a close. We'll have a Spartans beat writer here to tell us about the program's brand new head coach, Jonathan Smith. Then a Wolverines reporter will look ahead to Michigan's Big Ten championship game against Iowa and the potential playoff picture that could follow. That's all coming up on Michigan News from MLive.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
In May of 2020, protests erupted across the country after the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. Following the protests in Detroit, police officer Daniel DeBono faced criminal charges for shooting rubber bullets at photojournalists. MLive's Jordan Pear and Nathan Clark have both reported on this developing story over the past 3 years, and they're both joining us now. Nathan, let's start at the beginning. Could you walk us through the incident that led to the initial charges against Daniel DeBono?
Yeah, so like you said, it was late May 2020. We're in the height of COVID, and this was a few days after the death of George Floyd by the hands of Minneapolis police officers. Everybody in the nation was very displeased about this, and Detroit was no different, so there was thousands of people taken to the streets. And during the incident in Detroit, we had three photojournalists, one of which worked for MLive at the time, was shot at by a Detroit police officer, DeBono. She ended up suffering some pretty serious injuries to her arms and face from rubber bullets. And then after that, there was an investigation, and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office decided to press charges against DeBono.
And Nathan, you also reported on the initial trial in Wayne County back in 2021. What was the outcome of that case?
Actually, he didn't go to trial. It stayed in the district court because the judge found that DeBono, he had qualified immunity under state law. What that means is that everything that he was doing out there, they believe he was doing because it was part of his job. They believe that he was acting in a manner like in which he was trained, and all the photojournalists were not easily identifiable. It was a very chaotic situation, so the outcome for the court was he had immunity, and it just couldn't go any further beyond that.
So as you mentioned, those charges were dismissed by Wayne County District Court Judge Roberta Archer. But now this is being sent back to trial by the Michigan Court of Appeals. We'll turn now to Jordan Pear, whose latest story on the case is at MLive.com. Jordan, why are these charges coming back up?
Basically, when this went to the Court of Appeals, the appellate court ruled that the district court had misinterpreted the qualified immunity law. This was being hung on MCL 750.527, which deals with riots and other unlawful assemblies. And basically what the appellate court said is that that law provides, and this is a quote from their order, possible defense at trial, but not immunity. So basically they overturned the district court level and are sending it now to the circuit court.
And you spoke with DeBono's attorney for this story. What did they have to say?
DeBono's attorney was pretty adamant that, you know, if he was being ordered to basically keep watch over the city, and that if he had failed to do that, he would have been charged with neglect of duty and possibly other crimes. And she also said that, you know, we ask our police officers to serve and protect and then charge them criminally when they are protecting people, themselves and property. And that's a direct quote from her as well.
And finally, Jordan, it's been 3 years since the incident. What's next? And is there any idea of when we can expect a ruling?
When we can expect a ruling is pretty up in the air. Even for uncomplicated cases, these types of charges can take a really long time to get through court, let alone with complicated cases like this. So the next hearing for the case is scheduled for December 12th, but that is what's called a calendar conference, which is basically just for date setting and admin purposes. So it could be quite a while before it wraps up.
Nathan Clark and Jordan Pear are MLive reporters who have been covering this case involving a Detroit police officer who fired rubber bullets at photojournalists. You can learn more about this developing story by reading Jordan's article at MLive.com. Nathan, Jordan, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
A few weeks ago, we heard about backlash from Jewish politicians in Michigan after statements made by U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib. That was after Tlaib, the only Palestinian American in Congress, used a controversial phrase on social media. Tlaib says it was a call for freedom and human rights, but some, like Attorney General Dana Nessel, consider the phrase anti-Semitic. Tlaib was later censured in the U.S. House, and now a pro-Israel lobbying group is allegedly trying to unseat the representative from Detroit. MLive's senior political reporter Simon Schuster has been covering the story and joins us now. Simon, as you've reported, two Michigan Democrats claim they've been offered compensation to run against Tlaib. What can you tell us about those candidates and their claims?
Sure. So two Democratic candidates running for U.S. Senate to replace the retiring Debbie Stabenow, these are Hill Harper and Nasser Beydoun, allege that they were approached by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, a really influential lobbying group in Washington that promotes Israeli interests and Americans who support Israel in U.S. politics. And last week, Politico first reported that Hill Harper had been approached by a wealthy donor who said that AIPAC could offer $20 million for his campaign. That's $10 million in bundled contributions, meaning that individual contributors' donations would be sent to his campaign, and then $10 million in outside advertising, which is independent spending that is not subject to any limitations, if he were to drop his Senate campaign and then pivot to instead running against Rashida Tlaib in the 12th Congressional District. Tlaib, who is the daughter of Palestinian immigrants and a longtime outspoken advocate for Palestinian rights and Palestinian statehood, really has been a longtime enemy of AIPAC and their agenda. And so then earlier this week, Nasser Beydoun, who is also a Senate candidate, came out and said that he too had been allegedly made the same offer.
Marshall Whitman is the spokesperson for AIPAC, and he has addressed these claims in the media. What did he have to say?
Yeah, he essentially denied that this conversation, that these things ever occurred. He says he has absolutely no involvement in any way with these matters and had similarly denied the call with Harper, Hill Harper to Politico, which sort of leaves this in a gray area. Nasser Beydoun also had said that former Michigan Democratic Party chair Lon Johnson had essentially been the conduit for this offer. And Lon Johnson, while he didn't respond to multiple requests for comment from MLive, had told Politico that it was insanity, the idea that he would have offered any sort of financial support for a candidate to switch races.
And how about the two candidates, Beydoun and Harper? What was their response to these alleged offers from AIPAC?
Beydoun referred to the offer as borderline criminal, and Harper said that he couldn't be bought. And so both of these individuals are very much not in line with what AIPAC is trying to accomplish here, allegedly trying to accomplish, I should say. Beydoun is vocally pro-Palestine, and Harper similarly has made a statement for a humanitarian ceasefire in this conflict, which some proponents of Israel and its response have claimed that this is an unreasonable ask.
Finally, Simon, Michigan is home to the largest Arab American population in the country. How might the stances taken by politicians right now impact upcoming elections in the state?
Yeah, and this is, I think, a really important issue for Democrats to be encountering. There's a great story by my colleague Jordan Hermony that tackles this issue. But, Michigan has the largest Arab American population outside of the Middle East, in the community around Dearborn and Metro Detroit. And they feel essentially betrayed by Democrats, by President Biden for his response and his unqualified support of Israel. And of course, Republicans have pounced anytime that he gets towards speaking about any sort of equivocation towards these terms or calls for a ceasefire in this conflict. And so it's a really difficult position for Democrats to be in right now, where, at least in Michigan, they essentially have taken publicly a silent stance. When there was initially a lot of conflict and blowback in the legislature, they've decided instead to opt to say nothing at all. Now, at the same time, State Rep. Abraham Ayash, the majority floor leader, is participating in a hunger strike, calling for an immediate ceasefire in the conflict because of the increasingly desperate humanitarian situation in Gaza.
Simon Schuster is MLive's senior political reporter and has been telling us about alleged efforts by a pro-Israel lobbying group to unseat U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib of Detroit. Simon, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Patrick.
Again, as Simon mentioned, you can learn more about how some Arab American voters in Michigan are feeling by reading Jordan Hermony's recent story at mlive.com/politics. Big news for Spartans fans this week, and a big contract for a new head football coach, Jonathan Smith. Matt Wenzel is a beat writer covering Spartans football for MLive and has more on the new hire. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Patrick. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Well, it's, what has it been, 5 days or whatever it's been, 4 days since they hired a coach, so it's been pretty busy since Saturday.
Yeah, no shortage of coverage on that at our website, mlive.com, mlive.com/Spartans specifically. So Matt, let's start with some background on Jonathan Smith. What's his story and what led him to Michigan State?
Yeah, so West Coast guy. He, you know, he's born and raised in Pasadena, California. So I think he said he was born about a mile from the Rose Bowl. You know, he realized in high school that he wanted to get into coaching. So he thought he would take his best shot, the best opportunity he had at him to learn. And that was as a walk-on quarterback at Oregon State. And next thing you know, he becomes the starter. I think he started the first the final 38 or 39 games of his career. He led the Beavers to the best season in program history. They beat Notre Dame to win the Fiesta Bowl. So yeah, I mean, he left Oregon State as their career record holder in passing yards and passing touchdowns. So quite an accomplishment for a former walk-on. Michigan State fans know their program has a history of turning walk-ons into standout players. So, you know, that's, you know, it's an interesting part of his background and something he can coach off of. That's where he got his coaching career started. He had stops at Idaho, Montana, Boise State, Washington, and then he took over Oregon State before the 2018 season and spent six seasons leading his alma mater and, you know, took over a program that hadn't had much success, to say the least. They had won only one game the year before, went winless in the Pac-12, and took him a little bit of time. He had three losing seasons to start and then three winning seasons to close, including 10 victories last year, which is only the third time in program history the Beavers have reached that mark. So he was clearly a coach on the rise. He had other opportunities. He acknowledged yesterday that popped up that he wasn't interested, but the Michigan State one was different. He just thought it was the right fit time-wise with his family and what the program's about and kind of what Alan Heller, Michigan State's athletic director, kind of the vision he outlined was something that you know, Jonathan was on board with, and they just, it worked, and that's why he's the 26th coach in Michigan State history.
So it's clear that the athletic director at least is pleased with this hire. What about the fan base? What sort of reactions have you been hearing to Smith's appointment?
I mean, positive. I mean, if you listen to the talking heads in sports, the national people, other than the Oregon State fans who are understandably disappointed at losing him, it is seen as a really good hire. You know, he's a guy that, you know, a lot of programs would have been targeting, and Michigan State was able to pull it off. Alan was able to do it while keeping the search quiet, which was one of his priorities. He didn't want other schools, you know, that would have job openings looking at him as well. So I think, you know, it has been positively received by the fans. He was introduced at the Breslin Center last night during the first half of the men's basketball game, and obviously, a lot of applause, a lot of excitement there. So seems like a really good hire to me as well, but only time will tell.
Matt, on the latest episode of MLive's Spartan Confidential podcast, you talked about how even though Smith is a West Coast guy, like you said, he's never coached east of Missoula, Montana. In fact, my alma mater, by the way, go Grizz. You did draw an interesting parallel between the Oregon State program and the situation in East Lansing. Could you touch on that a bit?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's no secret that where he was coming from the rivalry is with Oregon. Oregon is clearly the bigger of the two brands. You know, it's Phil Knight, Nike University. Besides the resources, it's just, you know, nationally, Oregon will obviously be, you know, more in the spotlight. That said, he went 2-4 against Oregon, but he also had a, you know, those two wins came, were both upsets when Oregon was ranked 15th in 2020 and 9th last year. So he knows how to pull off rivalry upsets. He understands what it's like. And the parallel would be that obviously Michigan is more of a national brand than Michigan State. It's like that underdog upset, you know, upstart mentality. And he touched on that yesterday saying, yeah, you know, I don't like having a chip on the shoulder. He acknowledged the importance of the rivalry, said he understands it. So credited Michigan for, you know, their success and said, you know, next year's a new season. So obviously that's a big challenge in front of them. The gap between the two programs right now appears incredibly wide, but you know, college football can change in a hurry. And his goal will be to shrink that and, you know, get them competitive again with Michigan after this year, which was the worst loss in the 100-year history of Spartan Stadium, 49-0 to Michigan.
Matt Wenzel covers Michigan State football for MLive. You can read all of his work at MLive.com/Spartans. And you can hear much, much more about new head football coach Jonathan Smith by checking out the latest episode of the Spartan Confidential podcast. Matt, thanks for your time.
No problem. Thank you, Patrick.
While Spartans football has wrapped up for the season, the Wolverines are looking ahead to the Big Ten championship game on Saturday. Wolverines beat writer Aaron McMahon joins us now to preview that game and look ahead at the potential playoff picture. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Patrick.
So before we look ahead at Iowa, I actually want to take a step back and start with last week. Just how important was that win over arch rivals Ohio State on Saturday?
It's important as it gets. You know, every year Michigan likes to talk about bragging rights and beating your rivals and everything else. So I think it's good in that respect. But I think Michigan's defensive coordinator, one of their assistant coaches, Jesse Minter, put it perfectly this week. The Ohio State game kind of dictates Michigan's postseason hopes every year, the last 3 years. The win not only, you know, clinched the Big Ten's East Division title, but set Michigan into the Big Ten championship game this Saturday. And then assuming that they win that game, will put them into the college football playoff. So it really kind of dictated Michigan's success as a whole for the year.
And leading up to that game on the Wolverine Confidential podcast, you guys said that the game against the Buckeyes was sort of the real Big Ten championship, since either Michigan or Ohio State would be pretty heavy favorites over anyone in the Big Ten West. Do you still feel that way, or is there a chance that Iowa could cause the Wolverines some trouble on Saturday?
I do still feel that way. The odds makers currently have Michigan, I believe, is a 23.5-point favorite, which is one of the largest betting lines for Michigan this year in Big Ten play. So odds makers aren't expecting this game to be close. I think if you're asking most fans who watch Big Ten football and watch Michigan and even Iowa on a regular basis, well, I tell you, the Hawkeyes probably just don't stand much of a chance here. Michigan's, I think, complete on both sides of the ball. And while Iowa is very good defensively, they're one of the best in the country, they just don't have an offense. They're playing their backup quarterback, their best tight end, former Michigan transfer, Eric All. He's injured and not able to play. So the Hawkeyes just don't have the weapons offensively to keep up. And statistically, the stats will tell you that Iowa has one of the worst offenses in the country. So I don't expect Iowa to be able to move the football a ton. I think Michigan's going to just run the score up on them. Wouldn't shock me if it's a similar situation to 2 years ago when Michigan played Iowa in the Big Ten championship game and the final score ended up to be 42-3.
You know, there's been a real mismatch between the East and West in the Big Ten for a while now, but that should change next season. Could you just briefly explain the new format that's coming to the conference in 2024?
Yeah, certainly. The Big Ten is going to be eliminating the two division setup that it currently has. As things stand right now, as we're talking, the Big Ten is 14 teams, 7 teams in the East Division, 7 teams in the West Division, and it's largely set up geographically. The Big Ten is set to add 4 new schools to the conference next year, UCLA, USC, Washington, and Oregon. And if you haven't figured out by now, those are all West Coast teams. So it really kind of messes up the geographic footprint format for the Big Ten Conference. So they're going to eliminate the divisions and play with 18 teams next year and take the two best teams record-wise and play it in the championship game. So I think you'll probably get better matchups when it comes to the conference title game situation. As we were just talking about, there's really been an imbalance between the East and the West, really since they went to this two-division format 2011, certainly since 2014. The East Division has dominated, and there really hasn't been much of a competitive game there in the title game. So I think it's going to do wonders there. You're adding an influx of schools from the Pac-12 conference should help, and we certainly could see potential rematches here. That's something we've talked about a lot. We could see Michigan, Ohio State 2 weeks back to back. You know, think about it. The last 3 years, and including this year, Michigan, Ohio State would have met in the final game of the regular season and then played again a week later in Indianapolis, which is pretty wild to think about.
That would be wild. I mean, run it back a week later, see how that goes. Finally, without getting too ahead of ourselves, Aaron, let's talk playoffs. We'll have to wait to see how things play out across the country, really, on Saturday to get a better picture of which four teams might compete for a national championship. But if Michigan beats Iowa, they'll certainly be one of them. Just a personal question for you, Aaron. As a football fan, a reporter who wants to write about a good game, who would you be most intrigued to see Michigan face, and in which bowl?
Yeah, so there's probably a couple opponents here. I think for different reasons. One, I think Oregon sticks out here. They're going to play for a Pac-12 championship on Saturday against Washington. I think the winner of that game is certainly going to get into the playoff. I think Oregon's offense is fascinating. They got one of the best quarterbacks in the country in Bo Nix. He's up for the Heisman Trophy. They like to put up a lot of points, and their offense is really kind of geared to what Ohio State has done the last couple of years. So I'd be curious to see how Michigan would match up against them. And then Georgia, I think that's something naturally I think all Michigan fans want to see. Michigan played Georgia in the semifinal 2 years ago and lost pretty handedly. But I think Michigan's better prepared and more equipped to play them, I think, just from a physicality standpoint. So I think those are the two opponents I'm looking at. As for a bowl site, I think personally, and maybe, I think most Michigan fans would probably agree, the Rose Bowl is a spot I think folks want to go to. It's called the granddaddy of them all for a reason. It's Southern California. It's got a lot of history. And I think Michigan's, they played there a lot. It's been a while, but the program has rich history playing in Southern California. So I think all things considered, the Rose Bowl is probably the running favorite from myself and probably most folks paying attention.
Well, Aaron, thanks for joining us. Aaron McMahon is a Wolverines beat writer for MLive and a co-host of the Wolverine Confidential podcast. Tune in to watch Michigan play Iowa for the Big Ten Championship this Saturday, 8 p.m. Eastern on Fox. And make sure to check out Aaron's coverage of the game at MLive.com/Wolverines. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
There's no shortage of sports this weekend, with basketball and hockey in full swing. The Michigan basketball team heads to the West Coast to take on the Oregon Ducks Saturday at 3:30. That's before Big Ten play kicks off on Tuesday. It's Michigan-Indiana at 9 p.m. and Michigan State-Wisconsin before that, 7 p.m. on Tuesday. The Detroit Pistons set a record this week, and not the good kind. Wednesday's loss to the Lakers extended Detroit's losing streak to 15, the longest in franchise history. The Pistons host the Cleveland Cavaliers Saturday at 7 p.m. Meanwhile, the Detroit Red Wings are on the road in Montreal. They'll face the Canadiens also at 7 p.m. Saturday. And finally, the Detroit Lions look to bounce back from a disappointing Thanksgiving Day performance. They're headed to New Orleans this weekend to face the Saints. Kickoff is Sunday at 1 p.m. That's all for this week. I'm Patrick Shea. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.